For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right. Well, first question, where did this book come from? I thought about just, you know, what level we should use in terms of our approach and whether to avoid academic discussions. And I figure, you know, you guys are college students, you're used to this, so we'll include a little bit of academic consideration. I think really having confidence that in our understanding of the historical setting for a text, you know, is pretty important when it comes to interpreting that text and interpreting it correctly. The book itself is pretty unambiguous in where it came from. We see in chapter 17, 14, the Lord said to Moses, write this in a book as a memorial and recount it in the hearing of Joshua. Also in 24, 4, Moses wrote down all the words of the Lord. 34, 27, then the Lord said to Moses, write these words, for according to the tenor of these words, I've made a covenant with you and with Israel. So as we go through Exodus and really the other books of the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, it's clear that Moses writes all of them, and he is kind of writing in progress as this is going on. Jesus also confirmed that in his view, the Pentateuch was written by Moses when he said that because of the hardness of your heart, Moses wrote you this commandment. It was Moses that wrote these commandments in the Old Testament. The rest of the Old Testament is also unanimous in referring to the law of Moses, the books written by the prophet Moses, and so too in the New Testament. Very often, these books are attributed to Moses. Now, in light of that, normally when you find an ancient text of some sort, and it says it's written by somebody, it's, you know, you normally assume that that's telling the truth. But in the case of these books, there has been a vigorous, all-out attack on the integrity and the authorship of all of these books, and especially Exodus and Genesis. I'm going to be talking to you a little bit here for a few minutes before we start reading on something called the documentary hypothesis, a theory that the Pentateuch, the first five books, is a compilation of selections from different documents composed at different times over a period of five centuries, but all of them long after the time of Moses. The documentary hypothesis has every one of these books that have been stitched together in our present form written in the first millennium BC after 1000 BC. In fact, though, the book itself claims to have been written hundreds of years before that. This attack on the authorship, the notion that Moses wrote these books, began in the 1700s. Jean Ostrouk was one of the first that started to argue that he could sense that Moses, in his view, the editor, not the writer, but the editor, was using written memoranda to compile this account. In a book that I'm going to read you several comments from tonight by Old Testament scholar Gleason Archer, he points out that Mosaic authorship has not even been a live option for 20th century liberal scholarship. That battle was fought and won back in the early 1800s. This is so true. Go to Wikipedia and look up Exodus and read the article on it. Never considers the possibility that it could have been written by Moses or anyone close to him. That whole possibility is never discussed. It's not like some people believe this, but it's wrong for these reasons. It's just never discussed at all. And that's been pretty typical of the posture that modern scholarship has taken and secular scholarship has taken toward these books. Miller and Hayes would be a good example of one modern commentary. They say the main storyline of Genesis through Joshua is an artificial and theologically influenced literary construct. Old Testament scholar Robert Coote says the writers of ancient Israel knew little or nothing about the origin of Israel. So they're just making this up. They absolutely didn't know whatever happened in the dim shades of history. Because you have people here, you know, in the 700s, 800s BC, writing about events in the 12 to 14, 1500s BC. They're guessing. They never kept any record of what happened. And so these are folklore of Exodus, the conquest, and the period of the judges, all three. Coote says these periods never existed, never happened. Pure fiction, just like Jack and the Beanstalk or anything of that sort. In its final form, and one of the things I thought was cool in Archer's analysis of this, is he goes through the first 200-year history of this developing theory, the documentary hypothesis, what some call the Graf-Wellhausen theory, and shows how often it was changed and went from, you know, four sources to six to seven to eight, back to four, different orders, which one's older, which one's younger, different passages included. And it really, as you read through that, it's pretty boring reading, but it's effective. What you start to realize is how subjective this whole thing is and how opinion-driven it is and how it's not based on objective criteria at all. And finally, in the 1800s, it kind of came to rest in this form. The Yahwist, which is harkens back to the earliest theory where they argued that certain authors used the word Yahweh for God. Others used the word Elohim for God. So the Yahwist is the second source. And then later they admitted, well, that's not really true because the Yahwist source uses Elohim. The Elohist source uses Yahweh. So they dropped the criteria of divine names, but they kept the, it kind of is a signal of the subjectivity. They kept the name of the source, the J and E. The Deuteronomist, which basically comprises Deuteronomy, forged by the high priest Hilkiah just before 600 BC, the guy that came out of the temple saying, hey, King Josiah, look what we found. It's the law of Moses. Well, ink was still wet. He had just written it himself, and that's the book of Deuteronomy. And that's how we know the date of that. The priestly source, which is basically the book of Leviticus, written at the end of the exile of Israel into Babylonia. So we're all the way down past 500 when that book's written. And then all of it, there's a series of redactors that come at different stages in this development. And then finally, everything is kind of redacting is editing. The redactors would change things so that it fit together well. You know, if you read the book of Exodus or the book of Genesis, you'll be like, it's just a story. It's all one piece. There are no different sources here. What are they talking about? Oh, well, that's because of the redactor smoothed it out and made it seem like one story. But really, these were the folk tales of the northern part of Israel and the folk tales of the southern part of Israel that this redactor was stitching together and smoothing out so that there wouldn't be a division in the country, but they could all be of one point of view. That's the theory. And so you'll recognize J, E, D, and P as the five sources, and it also goes by that name, the JEDP theory. Still taught today as if nothing has changed from this very early time of development around 1800, so 200 years ago. I'm going to read you a few comments by Gleason Archer. Gleason Archer, the world-class scholar, a PhD, postgraduate study, studied in 24 ancient languages, really among the most learned men in this field that there are. Now dead, just died a couple years back. He says the documentary theory has been characterized by a subtle species of circular reasoning. It tends to posit its conclusion, which is that the Bible is not a supernatural revelation, as its underlying premise. There can be no such thing as supernatural revelation. If you are familiar with Enlightenment thinking, deistic Enlightenment thinking, you know how true this is. They are not willing to consider the possibility of revelation at all. And so no amount of evidence is going to shift that determination to discount this text. The Wellhausen theory was allegedly based upon the evidence of the text itself. And yet, evidence of the text is consistently evaded whenever it happens to go counter to the theory. Oh, well, all those references are later insertions made by priestly scribes who reworked these books after the exile. See, this theory that this is not, that these are come from different sources. And how do we know that? Just the discernment of the reader. It's not like we have manuscripts of different sources or anything like that. There's no actual reference to any of these sources in the literature. This is all just discerned by reading the text. And see, that's a Yahwist strata. That's a Yahwist strata there. And then if you're like, based on what? And if they name a criteria, then you're like, well, right here is exactly what you just said shouldn't be there, and it's right here in the middle of the source. So like, oh, well, that was put in by the redactor. The redactors made it seem like it was on. So, you know, what Archer's pointing out is it's an unfalsifiable theory, because you make your claims, and then wherever the data contradicts your claims, you say, redactor. The documentarians assumed that Hebrew authors differ from any other writers known in history of literature, in that they alone are incapable of using more than one name for God. They alone are incapable of using more than one style of writing, no matter what the difference in subject matter. They alone are unable to use more than one of several possible synonyms for a single idea. You get into this, you know, the bases for splitting these sources up. Oh, when he refers, you know, like if he refers to a spear, he calls it a spear. But when this source refers to it, they call it a javelin. So that shows there are two different sources right there. Like the same source couldn't say spear or javelin. That has to be a different author. They're unable to use more than one theme type or circle of interest. Everyone else is able to do all of these things, but the Jews, the ancient Hebrews, could not. The tendency has been to regard any biblical statement as unreliable and suspect, when any discrepancy with a pagan document, even one of a much later date, the other source is automatically considered a better historical witness. So, for example, Josephus quoting Manetho hundreds of years after the writing of the Pentateuch is favored over what the Pentateuch says, and which is a direct contradiction. Manetho had no contact. He's writing in the 400s BC. He had no contact with events 1,000 years before his time. All he had were rumors and legends that had been passed down, and yet that's put as more reliable than the text of the Bible. It shows a heavy bias on the part of these guys. It makes no difference how many biblical notices rejected as unhistorical by 19th century pundits have now been confirmed by later archaeological evidence, like the historicity of Belshazzar, the Hittites, the Horites. The same attitude of skeptical prejudice toward the Bible has persisted without any logical justification. Again and again, the biblical record has been vindicated against its critics by recent archaeological discovery. But Israel's religion was still explained away as a mere product of evolution, even though no other religion known, apart from offshoots of the Hebrew faith, has ever eventuated in genuine monotheism. That's something to think about. One of the things that, as we went through the 1800s, when Darwin hit, you know, Darwin explained natural selection and how evolution works. All the other faculties in European universities began to adapt Darwin to their field of study. So you have social Darwinism, the idea that societies are evolving. And you have religious Darwinism, which is what affects this, the idea that they kind of go in and try to mine for references to primitive notions like God actually talking to someone like a person. That's anthropomorphism. Well, that's got to be ancient. But then when we describe God as kind of this transcendent creator of all things in the universe, oh, well, that's a later picture there, because that's a more sophisticated, you know, concept of God. And so this is how things are dated. It's not that there's ever a date stated or any linguistic basis. It's content. It's the theological content more than anything else that's used to assign early and late dates based on a theory of religious Darwinism, of religious evolution. Overwhelming contradictory evidence from Genesis to Malachi that the Israelite religion was monotheistic from start to finish has just been evaded. A cynical reanalysis intended to show that a monotheistic veneer has been applied to the early believers. So they will come in, and of course the Old Testament, if you read it, it's monotheism, pure and clean all the way through. There is no polytheism, there is no animism there whatsoever. And that's true from page one on. But they will come in and say, oh yeah, but this was the redactor again. He smeared some monotheism over the obviously primitive polytheistic story. Doublets and couplets, where you tell a story here and you tell the same story over there for, you know, repeating yourself. Or expressions, repeating expressions. Every time that happens, they're like, oh, these are two that the redactor messed up. He didn't notice there were the same story was there in both, and he forgot to cut one of them out. He'd be really incompetent. Although other ancient Semitic literature show multiplied instances of repetition and duplication by the same author in their narrative technique, Hebrew literature alone cannot show any such repetitions or duplications without betraying diverse authorship. It's Semitic literature. They do this. It's a lot of repetition. It's a very poetic way of approaching stories. With highly questionable self-confidence, the Wellhausen school has assumed that modern European critics, who have no other ancient Hebrew literature with which to compare, for the biblical period at least, can, with scientific reliability, fix the date of composition of each document. This is an important point to realize, and a lot of people don't know this as modern readers. When we talk about the biblical Hebrew text originating 1000 BC, even further back, 1400 BC, we cannot compare the Hebrew used in that text with other Hebrew sources to determine whether it's old or young. See, if we could do that, then there would be a basis for dating the text based on analogy and comparison. But we have nothing in Hebrew from this period except for the Bible. It stands alone. Nothing else has survived. And so we're just left with pure speculation and subjective opinion. They've also assumed that scholars living more than 3,400 years after the event can, largely on the basis of philosophical theories like religious Darwinism, more reliably construct the way things really happened than could the ancient authors themselves. Yeah, so there's a real note of arrogance in this. Let's look at some of the internal evidence. There are many different ways that we could look at the positive evidence for Mosaic authorship, but I think one of the most intriguing to me is the internal evidence, just reading the text itself. Exodus 15:27 talks about how they got to this oasis and there were three wells there and 70 palm trees. So we're saying, okay, so this is folklore 500, 600, 700 years after the fact written, and they're going to tell you the number of palm trees at this oasis? See, that would matter to a thirsty people that have finally arrived at an oasis, but why would an author writing hundreds of years later include crazy details like that? Or this one, like in, if you read Numbers 11 about manna, and it talks about how it's, what it looked like, what it felt like, how to cook it, what it tasted like. So it tasted like coriander, sort of like coriander seed. And so there's these details put in that simply just seem very implausible that some ancient forger would waste ink on something like that. The author of it, the Torah, shows a consistently foreign, outside of Palestinian viewpoint. The flora and fauna he refers to are either Egyptian or Sinaitic from the Sinai Desert south of Israel. None of them are endemic to Israel. And how about this passage? Here's a good one. Okay. This is Genesis 13, part of the Pentateuch. This is from a late source. Lot, the nephew of Abraham, lifted up his eyes and saw all the valley of the Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere, like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt as you go towards Zoar. Okay. I don't know if you have, probably most of you have never been to Israel. It's a small country. It's like a little smaller than dividing Indiana in half vertically. That's about how big it is. Right through the middle of this country is this immense chasm. It's a rift valley. And down through the center of that is the Sea of Galilee, the Jordan River, and the Dead Sea. It dominates the whole country. You can practically see it from everywhere. You couldn't be in Israel. You couldn't live in Israel and not know about the Jordan River. That would be in the Jordan Valley. That would be impossible, totally implausible. So this author is saying, well, the Jordan Valley, it's very well watered. It's sort of like in Egypt as you're heading up towards Zoar. It's something like that. Are we seriously supposed to believe that folklore, Israeli folklore, would contain a description like this? Folklore that grew up in Israel, written by Israelis to Israelis. And that the author would be like, to understand the Jordan Valley, which completely, you know, dominates this whole country, think of Egypt as you're heading up towards Zoar. It's kind of like that. Think about that. Or are we to think that he's so smart that he's putting this in to seem like he's Moses writing this? You know, to believe that, you would have to know that this ancient author foresaw, anticipated that modern people, beginning in the Enlightenment period of Europe, would doubt Mosaic authorship. The ancients never doubted it. That's ridiculous. That's ridiculous is what that is. How about this one? Numbers 13:22. When they had gone up into the Negev, they came to Hebron, where Achiman, Sheshai, and Talmai, the descendants of Anak, were. Now Hebron was built 7 years before Zoan in Egypt. Again, this is a different town being mentioned in Egypt, but he's like, now Hebron, a well-known city in Israel, right in the center of it. And he's like, Hebron was built several years before Zoan in Egypt. Like, that would help Israeli readers. They've never been out of the country. They've never been to Egypt. There was no international travel in this day. And so to help you understand how long Hebron's been there, I'm going to tell you that it was built a few years before Zoan was built in Egypt. These are Egyptians reading this. They're not Israelis. It's exactly what it claims to be. These people, Moses and the people of Israel. Now, Moses had been there during the exile. He probably made it up there. And it seems like he perhaps had seen at least parts of the land of Israel, but the rest of them had never been there. All they know is Egypt. It's where they've grown up. It's where they've lived. So Egypt is used to explain things. Genesis 33, now Jacob came safely to the city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan. Like, they wouldn't know that Shechem was in Canaan? Everyone knows that lives there. It's obvious. This would be like saying, you know, we're Columbus, which is in Ohio. The only one you would say that to is people that have never been to Ohio. They don't know what's there. Numbers 10. This one's like, it describes, and then first leads out this tribe, and then after they're done, the next tribe goes, and it goes on verse after verse after verse, describing the order of departure when they would move camp of all of the tribes. Why would a later author include a crazy detail like that? These are the kind of things that would be written by an eyewitness sitting there with nothing to do and recording what's going on. Never would it be generated by later, a forger, archaic customs which are demonstrable for the second millennium BC, but which did not continue during the first millennium BC. Hittite suzerainty treaties is probably one of the best examples. The way the suzerainty treaty worked in the second millennium BC perfectly matches the way that the Pentateuch is written, especially in Exodus 20, the giving of the covenant, and Deuteronomy. It totally follows second millennium customs. We'll get to this a little bit more when we get there. And yet, these books are supposedly written in the first millennium. How did they know where the custom had completely changed and they don't follow the first millennium pattern? How did they even know what the custom would have been 1,000 years earlier? Ancient people don't have that kind of knowledge. Well, it's just bizarre. The data from archaeology were regrettably meager during the formative period of the documentary theory, and it was possible on the basis of the ignorance which then prevailed to discount many statements in scripture which had not yet found archaeological confirmation. Archaeology is a pretty young science. It really started in the late 1800s. At the time these theories were formulated, archaeological finds were negligible, and especially in the Middle East. All of our significant archaeology has been done since that time, in the late 1800s on, when this theory was already in place. So the theory was made in a vacuum of knowledge about the true conditions in that part of the world. For instance, they assumed that writing was unknown in Palestine during the Mosaic period. That was the first reason they said it must be from other sources, because no one that ancient knew how to write. Oh my God. We've got tens of thousands of tablets from Ebla and other sites right in this area of writing that go back 1,000 years before Moses, go back to 2400 BC. This belief that people didn't learn how to write until the first millennium is a complete joke now, but that was prominent in the thinking of these guys. References to the Hittite Empire were treated with incredulity and condemned as mere fiction. Enlightenment Europeans had never heard of Hittites before. They had no evidence in written sources. The classics mainly never referred to the Hittite Empire. Now we have mountains of data on this very prominent empire, which was never mentioned in sources like Herodotus and other ancient histories or Josephus, but which the Bible is very clear about that it was a major power, and it turns out that that is true. And so it's really funny to read the claims of scholars in the 18th and 19th centuries talking about how this is like a fictional empire that they used to believe existed. That really sounds foolish today. The same was true of the Horites. Even the historicity of Sargon II, whose library we have, an Assyrian king now, he wasn't mentioned for some reason in some of the statuary, but now they've excavated his library. We've got 20,000 tablets with his name on it. They knew nothing about the second millennium Hittite suzerainty treaties at the time, and not only the Jews wouldn't have known anything about it in the first millennium, but also these guys writing in the Enlightenment period knew nothing about that. That's all come to light since this theory was propounded. William F. Albright, one of the leading archaeologists of the 20th century, says Wellhausen, and he was a convinced disciple of Wellhausen and the documentary hypothesis. He came in as a believer in this theory. But after 40 years of excavation in Palestine, he says Wellhausen still ranks in our eyes as the greatest biblical scholar of the 19th century. But his standpoint is antiquated, and his picture of the early evolution of Israel is sadly distorted. John Elder says, little by little, one city after another, one civilization after another, one culture after another, whose memories were enshrined only in the Bible. Bible's the only one that mentioned them in any of our ancient literature, were restored through archaeology to their proper places in ancient history by the studies of the archaeologists. And Albright also says the new discoveries continuing to confirm the historical accuracy of the literary antiquity of detail after detail in the Pentateuch. He says it is accordingly sheer hypercriticism to deny the substantially Mosaic character of the Pentateuchal tradition. Albright's not speaking as a Christian. He doesn't believe in the inspiration of the Bible. He doesn't believe that it's from God. But he does believe, based on his extensive scholarship on site, actually looking at the sites and the digs there, that it's the whole thing is substantially Mosaic. I think it's very significant that we never have found a single shred of documentary evidence for any of these sources. What if we found an E source intact? Then you could argue this. See, that's what you need, is something like that. Never anything like that. The only texts we found are exactly like the Old Testament we still have today, including the Dead Sea Scrolls. The year 1485, approximately, we're ready to read. Exodus 1. These are the names of the sons of Israel, that is Jacob, who moved to Egypt with their father, each with his family. And it goes on to list all 11 brothers of Joseph. And of course, in all, Jacob had 70 descendants in Egypt, including Joseph, who was already there. So it's the 11 others. These 12 brothers are the basis for the 12 tribes of Israel. And so the tribes go by their name throughout the rest of the Bible. We read in 6 that in time, Joseph and all of his brothers died, ending that entire generation. But their descendants, the Israelites, had many children, grandchildren, and in fact, they multiplied so greatly that they became extremely powerful and filled the land. So the Jewish people moved down. This is really our first echo. We're getting hints here of what we know as the covenant. The covenant is God's agreement, God's promise to the Jewish people. It goes all the way back to the very ancient time, 600 years earlier than this, to Abraham, when God said, I'm going to make a great people out of you, and out through your descendants, every nation in the world will be blessed. The Abrahamic covenant. And in this passage, we should see that God is still working that covenant. Previously, Joseph had been sold as a slave into Egypt. If you know that story, this is just in the previous few pages there, the first last 10 chapters of Genesis. And he rose to become the second in command in Egypt to Pharaoh himself. In this highly, prominent and powerful position, he was able to summon his family from Palestine down to live in Egypt, and in this way, saved them from this horrific famine that hit for a 7-year period because Egypt had saved up food. Also, an interesting byproduct, the Pharaoh gave Joseph's family an area to live in called Goshen. And the Egyptians, as it points out in Genesis, really didn't like shepherds. They didn't like foreigners either. They didn't like people with hair. They thought that hair was dirty. They used to shave their heads. And very fastidious, very worried about dirt in Egyptian culture. So they didn't like hanging around with these furry Israeli, Jewish herdsmen with their dirty sheep. And so they would stay away from them. And unlike up in Canaan, where the Canaanites had no problem with the Jews and wanted to intermarry with them and, become buddies. And that was already happening before this move. The result being that the Jews were drifting into Canaanite religious perspective and starting to buy into their worldview. God basically got them out of that situation, put them down into Goshen, this area right in the Nile Delta, one of the most fertile places on earth, capable of supporting large populations of people because of the Nile sediments that are brought down every year up until the Soviets built the Aswan dams, kind of messed this up. But back in the day, this place would get flooded and dumped silt, a rich silt, every year. And so you could just, you know, crops would go like crazy there. God's got his people in this super fertile place. Nobody will talk to them or pay any attention to them. And they just breed like bunny rabbits. Everybody's having plenty of babies. No starvation, no famines. And they reach, you know, into the many thousands of people during this period. Passage of hundreds of years here. Verse 8. Eventually, a new king came to power in Egypt who knew nothing about Joseph or what he had done. He said to his people, "Look, the people of Israel now outnumber us and are stronger than we are." Okay, so this is a pretty strange passage. We've got this new king. He doesn't know anything about Joseph. He says to his people, that's a strange way of, it almost sounds like he's maybe not Egyptian, that his people are someone other than the Egyptians. Why would there be a need to say that? And he says, the people of Israel now outnumber us and are stronger than us. Can't believe an Egyptian would say that. Yes, they had multiplied and become numerous, not more numerous than the Egyptians, nowhere near. And not more powerful than the Egyptians either. In all likelihood, this is not an Egyptian king. The best candidate for this character would be one of the Hyksos pharaohs. The Hyksos, an Asiatic people who took over the Eastern Nile Delta during the 12th dynasty, initiating the second intermediate period of ancient Egypt. They were foreigners. They had come in from Asia and kind of filtered in. They didn't invade, but they filtered in through migration and became so numerous that at a certain point they rose up and got control of Egypt. A string of pharaohs starting in the late 1700s and down through the 1600s are called Hyksos pharaohs. You could see a Hyksos pharaoh saying these very things because the Jews probably were more numerous than them, were more powerful. They were not numerous. They were a small minority, but they got control of Egypt during this period. They are probably the ones that initially enslaved the Jews. Then, when they were pushed out, this following dynasty simply continued the policy of enslavement. So anyway, this pharaoh, this king, says we must make a plan to keep them from growing even more. If we don't, and if a war breaks out, they will join our enemies, probably the rest of the Egyptians, and they will fight against us. Then they will escape from the country. Or I think more likely, as NLT allows and so does an ESV, it could be translated, or take over the country. That's probably more what they were worried about. Well, in verse 11, so the Egyptians made the Israelites their slaves. They appointed brutal slave drivers over them, hoping to wear them down with crushing labor. They forced them to build the cities of Pithom and Ramses as supply centers for the king. And so all of this had been predicted in advance. So God has not lost control of the situation. Way back in Genesis 15, God had told Abraham, you can be sure that your descendants will be strangers in a foreign land where they will be oppressed as slaves for 400 years. But I will punish the nation that enslaves them, and in the end, they will come away with great wealth. So this had been foreseen way, way back. And sure enough, it was happening. But we also have here a reference to these two cities, Pithom and Ramses. This verse is the number one reason for assigning what is called the late date of the Exodus narrative to the Exodus being in roughly 1270 BC. The Bible itself says the Exodus was in 1446 BC. So there's quite a difference, quite a discrepancy here. 1 Kings 6:1 says it was in mid-spring in the month of Ziv during the fourth year of Solomon's reign that he began to construct the temple of the Lord. This was 480 years after the people of Israel were rescued from their slavery in the land of Egypt. We can date this event, the fourth year of King Solomon's reign, we can date to 966 BC exactly. From the time of the monarchy, which was hundreds of years after the Jews had returned to Israel, they set up a monarchy. Saul, David, Solomon. This was the third one in that monarchy. We can date all of the events in that to the year because of synchronism between Hebrew calendars and calendars of surrounding countries, which mention solar and lunar eclipses in the sequence of events. The calendars line up with each other and describe the same events, and so you get the whole thing falls out, and that's why historians can accurately date those events. Events back further where we are, they cannot date with that precision, except for statements like this. If we add 480 years to 966, then the Exodus would be in 1445 or 1446, probably 1445 because of the way they counted a partial year equal to whole. And so this is where most conservative scholars would place the time of the Exodus. The problem with that is this reference to building the city of Ramses. Ramses was built by Pharaoh Ramses II. Think, have you ever seen the Ten Commandments? Yul Brynner? What's his name? Ramses. What was the father's name, the good guy? Seti. Seti I, Ramses II. They're using this late chronology here. Ramses was one of the great pharaohs of Europe, or of Egypt. But this city, which is identified, probably to be identified with Pi Ramses, is the full name of the city, wasn't even started until 1270 range. And so how can it say that the Jews built this city if they were already gone from Egypt 200 years earlier? So here's our discrepancy right here, 1445 to 1270. Let me show you something that I think is a major problem. I believe the earlier date is the correct date. And here's one of the reasons. Even a lot of evangelical scholars go for the later date. I just am not convinced. 1210, there is an obelisk called the Israel Stela, which was produced by Pharaoh Merneptah. It describes a military campaign that he went up into Palestine, and he says he defeated Israel and describes that. We can guarantee that Israel is in the promised land in 1210 and no later than that. Before that, there has to be the period of the conquest where they came in and basically won this land away from other people. That would have to come before this. There was 40 years of wandering in the wilderness before that, right? So this is pushing us back. Before the Exodus itself, now there's a gap of time, but Moses had been 40 years in exile up in Midian. So now you've got 80 years plus the conquest, which is probably 15 or 20 years needs to be allowed for that if you read the book of Joshua. You need time for things like this. Also, how old was Moses at the time he was exiled from Egypt up into Midian? He was 40 years old. Guy lived to be 120 years, if we can believe this text. And, 1275 is the earliest date for the beginning of the building of Pi Ramses. They were already gone by then. They weren't even in Israel at that time. Pi Ramses should be over here, you know, because it describes the building of this city and the oppression and the destruction of Hebrew baby boys in that context. And Moses was born during the destruction of the baby boys. That's why he was put in a basket and in the river. In other words, this chronology simply won't work with the late dating. Hoffmeyer, who buys the late dating, he's an evangelical, he points out that there's work at Pi Ramses earlier, before the time of Ramses. But the whole point in his rap is that it says Ramses, and therefore it has to be the city of Ramses. How do we? Here's another text in Judges 11:26. This is spoken by a guy named Jephthah. He says, Israel has been living here for 300 years. Why do you make no effort to recover this land before now? This was stated in about 1100 by Jephthah and a negotiation that's described there, that would again take us back to 1400, for not for the Exodus, but for the entry into Israel. Because of the Exodus, 1445, 40 years of wandering, 1105, a great date for the entry of the Jews into. So from two different angles, it lines up on the old date. And I think the late date is wrong, and I'm going to be assuming the early date throughout this study. Why does it say they built the city of Ramses? It's a modernization of a city, the name of a city which was no longer in existence, which had been overlaid by Pi-Ramses. So, for example, you know, imagine a text referring to something going on in this area. And it's the land of the Mohicans or the land of the Cherokee. And they might, instead of that, because since modern readers have no idea what that refers to, might say it was in Ohio, even though Ohio wasn't even a state at the time. That's commonly done in all forms of literature. The city that was originally there was from the time of the Hyksos pharaohs. It was the capital of the country, Avaris. Avaris was absorbed into the new city of Pi-Ramses, constructed by Ramses II, 1279 to 1213, by the 19th dynasty, when he removed the capital from Thebes back to the delta. So, yeah, this would explain everything. Sure would. Does the Bible modernize names? Yes, it does. We can show this in other cases, like in Genesis 23, when Sarah was 127 years old, she died at Kiriath Arba, now called Hebron, in the land of Canaan. So at that time, it was called Kiriath Arba. Now we call it Hebron. You see this in many other passages, often without mentioning both names, just the new name is used. But at the time, it was actually called by a different name. And that's what we have here in Exodus 1:11. Okay, verse 12. The more the Egyptians oppressed them, the more the Israelites multiplied and spread, and the more alarmed the Egyptians became. So the Egyptians worked the people of Israel without mercy, trying to grind them down. They made their lives bitter, forcing them to mix mortar and make bricks and do all the works in the field in addition, farming, but also building the cities. They were ruthless in their demands. Then Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, gave this order to the Hebrew midwives, Ziphrah and Puah. Only two midwives working in Israel. Might mark that. That'll come up later. He says, when you help the Hebrew women and they give birth, watch as they deliver. If the baby's a boy, kill him. If it's a girl, let her live. And so we've got a grim situation where the most powerful ruler on earth at this time, the Egyptian Empire, is maximal. When this is happening, and he's decided he's going to treat the Hebrews like breeding stock. You know, this is something you would do with a herd of deer on your land or something like this. Kill the bucks, leave the does alone. And it's not going to happen, though. But because the midwives feared God, they refused to obey the king's orders. They allowed the boys to live, too. And so it's interesting, too, it's a little ironic to notice in this whole narrative, it's typical of the biblical perspective. This pharaoh is probably Thutmose III, the pharaoh at that time in Egypt. Strangely, he is never named throughout the Exodus. It just calls him the king or pharaoh. It never names who he is. But then you look at these two midwives. They get named in the text. It was Ziphrah and Puah. They're important. They were faithful. They refused to kill the babies. They went in and lied. The king of Egypt called for the midwives. Why have you done this? He demanded. Why have you allowed the boys to live? Well, the Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women, the midwives replied. They're no more vigorous. They're more vigorous, and they have their babies so quickly we can't get there in time. It was a lie. They were there. We already know that. So God was good to the midwives, and the Israelites continued to multiply, growing more and more powerful. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families of their own. Well, then Pharaoh gave this order, not to the midwives, but now to all of his people, and they probably will carry this out. Throw every newborn Hebrew boy into the Nile River, but you can let the girls live. Chapter 2. Now, about this time, a man and woman from the tribe of Levi got married. The woman became pregnant. She gave birth to a son. Uh-oh. She saw that he was a special baby and kept him hidden for 3 months. Eventually, when she could no longer hide it, she got a basket made of papyrus reeds and waterproofed it with tar and pitch. Puts the baby in the basket and laid it among the reeds along the bank of the Nile River. She did not push it out into the river. She put it in the reeds at the edge of the river. Okay, I'm going to make a point about this later. The baby's sister then stood at a distance, watching to see what would happen to him. They knew what was going to happen. They had intel. Soon, Pharaoh's daughter came down to bathe in the river. Oh, well, so this little basket's sitting right where the Pharaoh's daughter comes to bathe. It's working out pretty well, and her attendants walked along the riverbank. When the princess saw the baskets among the reeds, she sent her maid to get it for her. When the princess opened the basket and saw the baby, the little boy was crying, and she felt sorry for him. "This must be one of the Hebrew children," she said. Up pops Miriam, the sister. "Oh, got a little baby there, I see. Should I go find one of the Hebrew women to nurse this baby for you?" she asked. "I could probably work that out." "Yes, do," the princess replied. So the girl went and called the baby's mother, Yochebed. "Take this baby and nurse him for me," the princess told the baby mother. "I'll pay you for your help." So the woman took her baby home and nursed him with Pharaoh's daughter's approval. Later, when the boy was older, his mother brought him back to Pharaoh's daughter, who adopted him as her own son. The princess named him Moses, for she exclaimed, "I lifted him out of the water." The word Moses either comes from a verb meaning to draw out or from a stem having to do with water. We're not sure. And so Moses. Well. Looks like already in this story, God is at work. He's already got his man. This is going to be the dude that he's going to use. And he has him infiltrated into the palace of the most powerful monarchy on earth. Looks like things are going really well here. And yet, some of our assumptions might be pretty mistaken on this. The real truth, how they got to this point. Think about it this way. On one hand, there's the super spiritual perspective, which is what I was taught in Sunday school. I remember they said, they taught about this woman, you know, put this baby in the basket and then just pushed it out into the Nile River. And we're just like, "God, take care of him." And then he just floated down and all this other stuff happened. That would have been so random. That's not really what happened. You saw for yourself. This was not just a, "Okay, we'll just put him out here and just hope God works something out." What was it? It was a crafty plot hatched by these women. They knew where Pharaoh's daughter was going to come down to the water. They put it right there, not floating down the river. It was in the reeds. They stationed the sister there, hiding behind something, watching. They know exactly what's going to happen here. Now, of course, the daughter of Pharaoh had to feel compassion for the baby. That was God's part. And then she runs out. "I bet I could find a wet nurse for this baby for you." And so they've got everything. They got the whole plan worked out. They basically are in perfect position to where if God acts, they're going to be ready for it. So the super spiritual view that a lot of people are taught on this is just doesn't square with the text. On the other hand, you could see the humanistic view. Okay, so Moses, in the Pharaoh's palace, you're getting raised as an heir. You know, the Pharaoh's daughter adopted him. She must not have had kids of her own. Probably having maybe fertility problems. Good chance Moses is in line. He's either going to be the brother of the Pharaoh, or he could be Pharaoh. All he has to do is just work things right, play it cool, and he is definitely going to be in a position to change Egyptian policy and free the Hebrew people. Well, that's not how it's going to happen either. It's nothing like that. We're going way out into a very bizarre, totally different story than that. And so we have two kind of extreme assumptions here. On the one hand, there's God's part, which they're counting on, and yet there's human agency. So human agency and God's part really work together in this story. It's not one or the other. Either the humans have to pull it off, or we just close our eyes and hope God will do something. But rather, in human agency, we try to position ourselves so when God does act, we're ready for it. And we've done all that we can do from our side. And that's the picture. In the book of Exodus is really a book about God, the rescuing God, and how he rescues people. And so we want to keep an eye on that. And it's because it's also about how he works through human agents in the carrying out of his plan of rescue. That's what this book is about. But I'm sure that'll be very interesting. We'll take it up next week.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.